Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
You know, Dan, we have another Dan Rayburn joining us now. I've heard about him for several years from a lot of different people who say he's one of the most extraordinary people at getting events and getting people together. Dan Rayburn, welcome to the program. You're working with the National Association of Broadcasters with a very unusual conference that we want to talk about. But first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me today. So I've been in what I'll call the streaming media industry for about 23 years. I was fortunate enough to start one of the first streaming media production companies to do live webcasting back in the mid-90s, before the dot-com era. And so at the time, we were broadcasting audio-only streaming. There was no video, so we were doing a lot of concerts, mostly music, also some corporate events, some radio stations. We used to do all the first streaming for all the clear channel stations. And then, you know, video came about, and we started putting concerts online and traveling with bands, and that's right about the time in 96, 97 when the internet started to take off. People started getting 56K modems, some ISDN lines, and then it really took off. You know, we started broadcasting video at 300 kilobits per second, so back then that was considered like today's version of HD. So I did that, sold that business, and then went to an ISP in New York City that raised $600 million in a bond offering. They were public. So ran a small group there for inside a larger organization. So my background is focusing on how streaming media technologies, you know, impact everyone in the broadcast, the enterprise, the education, the marketing, the entertainment space. And, you know, I've sort of always been seen as sort of the spokesman for our industry. So I do a lot of work in terms of writing and lecturing and teaching and books. And I talk to regulators, people in Congress and Senate who are looking to pass laws and wanting to know how it impacts our industry and consumers. So my job, as I like to say all the time, is my job as I see it is to inform, educate, and empower others on how these technologies can be used and what the benefit is.
Well, that sounds exciting. And what's happening in Las Vegas?
So Las Vegas, each year, the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, puts on a very large show. It's a couple days long. They have over 100,000 attendees, over 1,000 exhibitors. And it's always been really one of the best or the best show to go to in terms of size when it comes to anyone tied to video. So if you're doing anything in terms of satellite communications or camera work or ingestion or transcoding of video, editing, pre- and post-production, that's the show to go to. And what's been missing from the NAB show is a very clear focus on the streaming media ecosystem. So I'd put on shows for 15 years in New York, California, and in Europe around this topic with another news organization, and left there in December and had been talking to the NAB about really bringing a lot of very clear, concise focus to their show. So what we did is we created a partnership and launched a new series of shows called The Streaming Summit by Dan Rayburn. So it will launch one day in Vegas on April 11th, and then in the New York NAB show in October, it'll expand to 2 days, and then it'll have a lot more content, and then in Vegas next year, it'll be 2 days. So the show will continue to grow, and the goal is to really bring in the best speakers and companies talking about what they're doing with the technology, the applications it enables, the use cases it enables, and highlighting those. And then in addition, we'll announce additional brand new shows for the NAB around certain facets of the overall topic.
When you say streaming, are you just talking video or video and radio? What do you mean by that?
Sure. So streaming is just a technology. So it's the underlying technology that enables radio streaming. It enables TV broadcast, TV everywhere, OTT, everything the MSOs and the MVPDs are doing. So any form of video that's being transmitted basically over IP is really what streaming talks to. But we like to think of it as the ecosystem. So you have to create content, ingest it, transcode it, store it, manage it, protect it, monetize it, syndicate it, deliver it, track it. That's the entire ecosystem. So streaming ecosystem is made up of lots of different vendors and solutions in each one of those silos, some that offer an end-to-end solution and some that do just certain pieces. And that's what the NAB shows are really about, is allowing content owners and broadcasters and syndicators and folks like yourself on the radio side to come and hear how these technologies work, see what the latest and greatest workflow solutions are, and basically help companies do more with less.
Yeah. Well, you know, we are a totally virtual studio, et cetera, doing our program. Could I just concentrate before I turn it over to Dan on radio streaming, which from everything we've heard, is just exploding in the last couple of years. But it doesn't seem to be much measurement going on as to what is really happening. When people ask us for figures, we give them to them, and they look at us as if we were talking Swahili. Well, what is being done to measure all of this, and what ideas do you have?
Well, it's a great question. You know, measuring radio and measuring what's taking place with video online are really two completely different things. So you have Nielsen, you have ComScore, you have Arbitron, you have all these services out there that are measuring things. But up until pretty recently, they were not measuring what's taking place when it comes to streaming and streaming live. So they've made some announcements recently over the last year of how they're now going to be monitoring some of that usage from a reporting and analytics standpoint. So they basically have a methodology. The problem we have in the industry is that some of the companies who they're going to be monitoring have come out and said, well, your methodology is not accurate. So you're going to be giving out data that's not data that we don't agree with. So part of the problem here is, if you think about, take someone as big as Netflix or take somebody who's super small, none of those companies share any of their data. You know, Netflix says, well, we have 110 million subs or whatever the latest number is, but they don't say how many users watch how many videos or how often or how long or how many times during the day. Nobody releases that. Nobody says what they're actually doing. They keep all that private. So as an industry, how do we measure and monitor and look at the success of the industry when nobody's willing to release their data? It's very difficult. So that's part of the problem the industry has.
You're very, very right on that. It's a problem we have. Dan, I have a lot of questions, but over to you.
Thank you. I'm curious about this last dialogue with Don concerning measurements. We find ourselves in a kind of a catch 22. We're on 12 radio stations. We're on iHeartRadio. We're on Roku. And we have all of our programs are archived on YouTube videos on our website. So every program that we've ever done is available for downloading and viewing whenever you want. So we get streaming numbers. In fact, we got them today, of about 150,000 streams a week on our two programs. And so that we know there's about 70 to 80,000 Roku subscribers, and we know that it's available on iHeartRadio. So we're available in a lot of different places, but you're absolutely right. It is damn near impossible to figure out what our total audience is.
Yes. So that's what we call fragmentation. There's just fragmentation in the market because you have so many platforms. You know, you're a great example, a content owner. You want to put your content in front of your listeners in as many places as possible, which means you're in lots of different platforms and different devices. But then
right.
how do you aggregate all of that data? How do you aggregate all of that usage? Anyone can just go, well, we got 50,000 streams. But that doesn't really tell you much. So actual user interaction, engagement times, these are the new KPIs that people are talking about, that metrics they're using to really measure the success. Because a lot of people would rather have fewer streams delivered, but those people are staying on for much longer, listening to more or watching more, which means more ads are being delivered, hopefully, which means hopefully the content's being monetized better. But it's still in the early stages, 23 years later.
So what is KPI?
So KPI is a way to measure what's taking place in a market. So a KPI is a generic term that's used in the industry. It stands for key performance indicators. So whatever industry you're in, pharmaceutical, agricultural, Wall Street, we all have different KPIs. But in the online video audio world, you know, the KPIs that people are starting to look at are not just how many streams did you do or how many hours or what was the bit rate. They're looking at what was the engagement time. How much did that person interact or engage with that content? How many ads did they watch? So they're starting to look at what we would consider real business metrics for KPIs.
So let me take it one step further. I personally have a situation where I've got a Facebook marketing campaign for three of my books, and we originally, when we first did it, we went directly, the link directly to Amazon, and my publisher can't give me the information until once a quarter. So then we started a new campaign on Sunday with the three books in a package in an audio book, and the first day we got over 10,000 click-throughs, but we're still not able to find out how many of the 10,000 actually bought the books. We're still dealing with that. But in speaking to my webmaster today, they were suggesting that we should probably sign up for Google's analytics. And as I understand it, you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, you can sign up to enroll your website, your whatever, in Google Analytics, and they will provide you a lot of the data that you're talking about through Google Analytics. Is that the ultimate solution, is having
no,
a
it's not
program?
The ultimate solution. I mean, Google Analytics is great. It's free. You know, you put a little line of code in, and it works well in terms of collecting a lot of basic information, high level. Who's coming to your site in terms of geography? What browser are they using? What device? How long did they stay on your page? What's the bounce rate? It's a really good free platform for getting a lot of the basics around your content. But when it comes to, you know, audio listening or video watching, it's not going to say, you know, six people listen to your stream for 4 minutes and 12 of them listen to it for 10 minutes. It's not going to give you that type of granular information you need down on a stream level. And that's typically what you're getting from a content delivery network. You're getting that from a third-party site like a Conviva, a Nice People at Work, Hola, TouchStream. There's a bunch of third-party companies that content owners use on the audio and video side to get very, very granular information.
But what I guess what I was where I was headed with Google, perhaps what the industry needs in order to perhaps, for a lack of a better word, to standardize the reporting, is that maybe the industry needs a third party or third parties that do the work for you, and you enroll, and they independently, depending upon what level of services and data you want, they can get all of it for you.
Yeah, so that sounds like a great idea, and that sounds logical, but that's the problem. You can't think about this logically. And the reason for that is you're not going to get Microsoft and Google and Facebook and these big companies to work together. They don't want to work together. They're competitors. And that's why we have no standards in the video world online. Like, think of the broadcast world. In the broadcast world, what's HD? Well, we all know. It looks exactly the same when you turn on your TV. When you go on the internet, what is considered an HD stream? Is it the bit rate? Is it the aspect ratio? Is it the codec being used? We don't know. There's no definition. No one's agreed on anything. So there are no agreed upon standards on pretty much anything in the video world. No format, bitrate, codec, aspect ratio, player protocol, nothing. So
but what about
the
what
problem
about
is that
radio? What about radio? Is that easier to do than video?
To a degree it is. But the problem you have there too is you have so many different companies that control so many different stations that the way they want to report on their information or data is different because their advertiser might want it one way and another advertiser wants and measures it, you know, somewhere, some way else. So advertisers measure this usage differently as well. And they're determining based on their specific KPIs and needs, how they then buy ads. So when you don't have a standard amongst advertisers, the IAB has been trying to do that for a long time, create that standard. And some companies apply the IAB standard to their business, but then others don't because they don't agree with it.
It's interesting that what you were just saying about so many differences. There seems to be in radio, it can't say it is true necessarily in television, but the Sinclair Communications situation recently, that there seems to be a greater and greater concentration of fewer holding companies owning more and more radio stations in broad markets.
Sure, absolutely. Fewer companies are controlling more. It's the same in my industry on the video side. You think of the content side. You know, AT&T is trying to buy Time Warner right now. Comcast bought NBC. You have these all these companies consolidating because they want to own more content because content is king. So they want to own distribution and they want to own content both together as a package. So just like we're seeing that in radio, we're seeing that on the traditional TV side as well.
And can we compare the content issue for radio and television to what's going on in Hollywood, the general rejection of the quality of the content in the movies over the last couple of years? And I looked recently and saw a report of something like 33 television shows that are being canceled in the upcoming season, and that there seems to be a thirst. I mean, the last thing I saw was that Hollywood was talking about doing 27 sequels this year in new movies. 27. And we see the spinoffs on television. We have, and I didn't get a chance to see it, but I will, Roseanne coming back with her show, which is politically incorrect and very pro-Trump, yet it did huge numbers. And I saw over the weekend the producers are trying to get her to agree to do a 22-week season for a new renewal for next year. And she's saying, nope, we're going to do 12. And so they're start. So in general, there seems to be a starving mechanism for lack of quality content.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, but that's something that Hollywood has always struggled with. I don't think it's so much new. I think what's changed is the way content's been packaged has changed that. So you have shorter form content. You have content that's originally created now just for the internet at a cheaper cost. You have contents being packaged and windowed differently. Studios are releasing content to streaming at times when they're releasing it to DVDs. The entire way that consumers now interact and consume with that content has changed, and it's really messed up the studio's business because the studio's historically, what? It comes out in the movie. After the movie, it comes out in, what, HBO. You know, it comes out in DVD. Like, it was just this regimented, regulated way of releasing content to the market. And that's completely been thrown for a loop. So now not only is the distribution mechanism changed, the packaging of that content has changed. And now to your point, the actual content itself has had to change. And sometimes it's a hit or miss. Look at all the shows Netflix and Amazon have had to cancel because they didn't do well after one season. So part of it is a guessing game.
Isn't the same thing true related to radio and television, that there is, seems to be, I mean, I use this as an example. If you occasionally, if you happen to listen to Rush Limbaugh, he'll have, when there's something being said, he will do compilations of, you know, 10, 12, 15 different people on the various networks on television or radio, all literally using the same words. It's like there's no original content. It's like somebody put out a script of the day, and this is what everybody says. I mean, literally verbatim.
Right. Packaging. It's how you package content, and that's the key. You have to understand what content consumers want to listen to or watch, and then you have to understand how to package it. And then the third part is you have to understand how to deliver it to them. What is the best way they want to have it delivered in front of them?
Let me ask one more question, then I'll throw it back to Don. What do you expect to accomplish at the show in April?
The biggest thing to accomplish at the show is just educate people on a lot of the questions we're talking about. You know, we have every major broadcaster there, an OTT provider and content owner and distributor and syndicator, along with all the vendors, along with people from Wall Street, along with the media that's reporting on all this. So our job is just to provide the best information we can to educate the entire industry that touches streaming media in some way so they understand reality of what's going on, setting proper expectations. Here's what we have going in the market, and here's what's coming up.
Yeah. Thank you. Don, back to you.
Well, first, Dan, your website where people can find out more about the show and more about you?
Yeah, absolutely. They can go to nebstreamingsummit.com. And if they want to follow me and my blog, where I've been writing for 10 years about all this, they can go to streamingmediablog.com.
Well, we've got far afield, but I don't think so. I'd like to ask you, several times we've had guests on this show who said, gee, they have small businesses, and they say they're thinking of creating their own podcast or streaming program. What do you say to that, and how do you think that they should go about it, doing that if indeed they want to do it?
Yeah, well, a couple things I'd say there is, you know, it all comes down to what is it you're trying to do. So if you literally just want to use these platforms and these applications to get your message out there, that's great. That's exactly what they're used for. You can do it at almost no cost. Most of them are free, like podcasting. It doesn't cost you anything to do it. It costs your time and effort to create the content. So if you just want to do it to get your information out there, that's great. The problem is you have a lot of people who think, oh, I'll start a podcast tomorrow. It'll get a million listeners, and I'll sign up thousands of dollars in advertising dollars. That's not reality. Okay, it doesn't work that way. So unless you already have a distribution and a following and a way to promote what you're doing, you can build traffic, but it's going to be small traffic over time. The great news is, though, nobody should shy away from wanting to do a podcast because it's free. It's easy to do. And there's tools and resources online that will walk you through the entire process. So I like the idea of people doing that. Just be realistic in terms of what you think your outcome is going to be.
Well, I will say, Dan and I, when we started out, we jumped off the cliff, and we had a few tumbles before we landed. But I'd like to get a question. When we talk to advertisers, they say to us, well, what is your download? And then we get into a big discussion of whether a download is a full download or a partial download. And since we have someone as smart as you about this and knowledgeable, what are some of the measurement tools that you think can help people not only find advertising, but measure their success?
Well, it's a good question. The issue is when you're looking at something like podcasts, it's very different than radio and it's very different from video. You know, some people download podcasts, put them on their phone or device, and they listen to it later. Other people just stream them. It's not a download. So basically what the advertiser wants to know is it goes back before what I said to engagement. You know, if somebody only listens to the first 3 minutes of a 60-minute long podcast, there's not much engagement there. So they want to know, okay, did the average person listen to at least half of it? So they want to know, okay, if they're listening to half of it and they're the sponsor, and you mentioned the sponsor's name the first, you know, let's say three times in the first 30 minutes, they know that X amount of listeners heard their name mentioned as a sponsor X number of times over a period of time. So that's engagement to them. So what they're looking is they're trying to figure out how many of the people listening did we actually get across to and what was the message that we got across to them. But advertisers measure that in very different ways.
That's very true. We only have a little bit of time left, but I guess my question, then I'll turn it back down to Dan, is at your program, will attendees be able to mingle with the panelists? I mean, how are you setting it up so that it can be a truly interactive experience?
Yeah, of course. So it's set up. Some of these are standalone presentations where you're actually showing the audience how to do things. You know, step by step, here's how you do it, best practices and use cases. Others are fireside chats with myself talking about bigger topics like we're talking about today, where the market is going. And then a lot of the sessions are moderated with four speakers in a roundtable setting where they're talking about facets of the overall topic and the key trends, and they're answering key questions like what should be the KPIs that we're measuring our industry on. And then attendees have the ability to ask questions to the speakers on the stage for the last 10 or 15 minutes. And then after the session is over, yeah, of course, any attendee can walk right up to the speaker and ask additional questions. And then we have a big beer garden networking event the night before as well. So there's also lots and lots of networking taking place.
Well, I think anybody that's interested in streaming in any sense should be there. Dan, I'll let you take the last two questions.
Thank you. In listening to the dialogue there, makes me want to ask a question, Dan. And that is, you were very specific about if you've got an hour program and the customer, the sponsor, wants to hear himself or his product mentioned three times in the first half hour, it's measurable. That causes me to want to ask the question, what would be an appropriate length for a podcast today?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, great question. I think, frankly, a podcast should be no longer than 20 minutes. People want something that's digestible. Hey, I just learned a whole bunch of stuff in 20 minutes. Great, I can move on. 20 minutes is enough time in a car, enough time in a subway. You know, people who podcast are an hour and then they cram three speakers into it. They should really be breaking that up. So I believe a podcast should be 20 minutes or less.
So if you have an hour program like we do and we bring on two guests and we're 20 to 23 minutes, we're really doing two shows.
Right. You are. Yeah. And
it comes across as one, but we're really doing two.
Yeah, and it depends how you break that up. Keep in mind, let's say your two guests are both talking about a topic that's similar and relevant, it makes sense that you might keep it together. But if you're talking about two completely different verticals and topics, you might break those up into two shows because you're going to promote those two shows differently to a different audience.
That's a great answer. I appreciate that. Thank you. Back to you, Don.
Well, again, we're talking with Dan Rayburn. Give our audience one more chance to know about your upcoming program and how they can reach you.
Sure. They can go to nabstreamingsummit.com for the show information. They can go to Streaming Media Blog for my blog information, or they can just email me directly if they have any questions, dan@danrayburn, RAYBURN.com.
Dan, thank you so much for being with us. It's been illuminating for me, and I'm sure for Dan. And Dan, what do you think?
No, I think it was very interesting, and it gives us a lot to think about. So thank you for joining us today and providing a lot of great information, and good luck with the show.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me. Take care.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
The gig economy is all around us, and Michael Daddio, who is the principal for tax and business at Marcum LLP, is here to talk about how a gig worker can save up to $5,500 on their income tax, as well as help their small business client. Michael, welcome to the program. Before we do anything else, Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'm a principal at the New Haven office of Marcum LLP. We're a full-service accounting firm doing assurance and tax work as well as valuations and other things that major accounting firms do. But my specialty is in the area of taxation.
That's a, well, you know, the saving on taxes is what everybody would like. But you've given us an intriguing proposition, which is that the gig worker, which is rapidly becoming a vital part of our economy, can somehow or other save money. So from that viewpoint, start and let us know.
Well, there are in particular two issues under the new tax law that helps the essentially the independent contractor, the gig worker, because one is the elimination of miscellaneous itemized deductions for employees. So if you have employee business expenses that you've been able to deduct through 2017 and 2018, those deductions go away. They're not part of the return anymore. Whereas if you're an independent contractor and you have the same expenses, but they would be considered trade or business expenses, those items are deductible. So you get a reduction in the amount that you're paying tax on that way. And, of course, the second item is the qualified business income deduction, which for certain businesses subject to certain limitations can provide a deduction of up to 20% of the net income earned by the independent contractor, as opposed, again, to an employee who doesn't get that comparable deduction.
I'm going to turn it over now to our financial expert, Dan.
Michael, welcome to the show. And you took my breath away on your last statement. So we're going to go back and harvest a little bit of that. I am an independent contractor right now, personally. And I have a consulting business where I do work for industrial companies or media companies or whatever. And you're now saying that things got even nicer for me because if I was an employee, there would be a limitation or a total elimination of travel and entertainment expense for one. But as a gig, I can deduct that. But tell me how, and your last statement, how this is going to work for me, because I'm intrigued about up to 20%. So take a moment and fill us in.
Okay, we'll focus on the 20%, but I want to get back to the travel entertainment because those rules have also been changed. But let's just focus in on the what's called the qualified business income deduction. And
yeah,
this is relatively complex. Okay, so it's not a very simple rule, but the basics behind it is, since they reduced the corporate rate from a maximum 35% to 21%, and that would apply to C corporations, they wanted to provide a benefit, Congress did, for businesses that operate in a flow-through pathway, whether they're self-employed people, sole proprietorships, whether you're operating through a partnership or an S corporation where the income flows to the individual owners and they're the ones that get taxed on it. So what they developed was this qualified business income deduction, which is potentially up to 20% of the net income earned by the business. So if you earn $100,000 in self-employment income as an independent contractor, you would essentially pay income taxes only on $80,000. But there are some limitations on that rule. So it doesn't apply that simply to everybody.
Okay.
And basically, if there are two limitations on the rule. Okay. One is it doesn't apply to certain specialized service businesses. And the second is a W-2 limitation, a wage limitation, that acts as a limit on the deduction. But let's start with the simplest rule. Okay, if you make under $315,000 of taxable income on a joint return,
mm-hmm.
and under $157,500 if you're filing a single or separate return, then you get this 20% deduction regardless of the type of business you're in, and you don't have to worry about there being a wage limit. You just get the 20%.
It's 20% of the gross or net after expenses?
Net after expenses.
Okay.
There mm-hmm. was a glitch in the law that was just fixed under the omnibus bill that did allow a 20% gross deduction with respect to certain cooperative dividends, but that was eliminated. So for everybody, it's going to be 20% of the net. Okay, now that's if you make under those dollar amounts, and that's the simplest version. And that will cover a lot of people.
Under 315
for joint return, and 157.5, which is half of that amount, for any other single filer, head of household filer, or married filing, separate filer.
In previous years, because I'm self-employed and I'm not a W-2 employee of anybody, I had to pay a self-employment tax. And are you
That's correct.
Is that what you're talking about is being reduced, that self-employment supplemental tax?
No, you're still going to pay self-employment tax if you are an independent contractor, and you're going to pay it on the full amount of the self-employment earnings. I'm talking about the actual regular income tax you pay.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right.
Not the self-employment tax, but the just the regular tax that is paid on this income, there is this 20% deduction that will apply if you're under these income limits.
Now,
okay,
what happens if you make more than 315?
If you make – we're going to take this in two steps because, again, it gets a little complicated. If you make more than 400 – yeah, if you make more than $415,000 – which is $100,000 over the $315,000 limit. So you make more than $415,000, or you make more than $207,500, which is $50,000 more than the 157.5 limit we just talked about for single filers. If you make more than those amounts, then you can still possibly get the 20% deduction, but there are two limits you have to be careful of. And one limit is a wage limit. Okay, you can't get any more than the larger of two alternative limitations. Okay, one is 50% of the W-2 wages that you pay to other people. Okay, or alternatively, 25% of the W-2 wages plus 2.5% of the basis, unadjusted basis, of certain business assets that you use in your business. Very complex rule.
Let me try to say that in a different way by asking you a simple question. If when I sit down like I just did, and sent off to my CPA all of my tax information. If none of the things that I sent him had the letters W-2 on it, how does that affect me?
Okay. You as the independent contractor, it's not the amount you earn, but it's the amount you pay. So if in your business, your, let's say your independent contractor business, if you don't pay anybody else a salary, you will be, and you make over these income limits, your deduction will be zero because it's going to be limited to the smaller of the 20% of the earnings that you make or 50% of the wages that you pay to third parties. And so if you don't have a payroll and you're making over these income limits, then that limitation will cause you not to be eligible for the 20%.
So if I make, if I'm a sole proprietorship, I have no employees, I have no W-2, and I make less than $315,000, do I still get the 20% exemption?
Right. You get the 20% because you're not worried about any of the limitations on the 20% if you make under the 315 of taxable income.
Mm-hmm.
And you file a joint return.
Right.
But if you make over 415, then you've got to worry about this 50% of W-2 wages or the alternative 25% wages plus 2.5% of unadjusted basis of assets. So you don't know that you're going to get the full 20%.
So if I, but if I make more than $400,000 or so, do I lose the 20% on the first 315? I lose all of it?
That's right.
Okay. All right. So.
And there's a an important second limitation. If you make more than $415,000, certain service-related businesses are not eligible for the 20% at all. Whereas
so,
if you're under 315, it doesn't matter.
What are those service industries?
Well, there are industries in the area of health, like doctors, law, lawyers, accountants, actuarial science, performing arts, consulting, athletics, financial services, brokerage services, and kind of a catch-all, which we're not exactly certain what this means. We're waiting for guidance from the service. Any trade or business where the principal assets of the business is the reputation or skill of one or more of the employees or owners. So, for example, if you say I have a consulting business and you provide consulting services, well, consultants are one of the businesses that is considered a specified service business. If you make too much, your business doesn't qualify. You're not going to be able to get the 20%, regardless of what you pay in wages. If you're not under one of those categories I just described of service providers, then your business will be eligible for the 20%, but you are subject to that wage, either wage limitation, the 50% or the 25% with the 2.5% of basis of business assets as a limitation on the dollar deduction. And if you're between, just say, if you're between 315 and 415 on a joint return, you're in between the ranges, then there's a phase out of these rules, which I don't even want to begin to describe.
I understand. Michael, I have to ask one more question, then I'll turn it over to Don. I want to talk about Michael now, you. You are in one of those organizations that are having some problems under, quote, services. And I pay a CPA a lot of money to do my tax returns. And in the past, I paid it out of the, because of the bulk of my income is corporate income, not investment income. He provides advice and counsel in my businesses too. And so I pay him out of the business. But it sounds to me like, Michael, that it says that in the future, if I make certain amounts of income, I can't deduct the fee that I would be paying my CPA or some of your customers may be paying you to do your business. Is that true?
Okay, and that is because of the rule that eliminates miscellaneous itemized deductions. So, I mean, if you are an individual, an employee, and you pay somebody to prepare your return, that deduction normally would be taken on Schedule A as a miscellaneous itemized deduction. And those deductions
right.
have been eliminated. On the other hand, if you are a business and you pay somebody for doing your business return or your business accounting, then that's a trade or business deduction, which should be deductible.
Okay, good. Super. Thank you. Don, back to you.
Oh, Dan, I'm hoping you can take the whole thing.
I'm always amazed
by how Congress comes up with this convoluted, well, you do 25% of this and 15% of that, and if you go over that, why can't they do a simple, straightforward laws that would make it simple for guys like me to understand? But then again, they wouldn't. People like Michael might be out of business. But do you know what I'm saying, Michael? If I'm listening to you, and I'm just sitting here amazed that they put a new law in, they couldn't make it simple.
Yeah,
there is actually some logic behind the complexity, because the concern that they had was that to the extent that somebody's in a true service business, a good portion of what they earn really is for doing work. I mean, the actual service they provide. And that where, as an employee, doesn't get this benefit. They did not want somebody who just says, I'm an independent contractor, to be able to get the benefit where a regular employee wouldn't. That would make the owner of a business paying less taxes than his employees, potentially. So that's why they added some complexity here, one of which is be certain you're paying other people so that you can at least there's some benefit to third parties, you know, as a result of the business before they'll give you the deduction if you make enough.
So, Michael, I have a question. Go ahead.
Let me ask mine and then you can but, Michael, Dan and I are both national commentators, okay? And the reputation we build in our respective companies, and if I heard you correctly, if you we would not be if we did consulting, we would not be able to deduct it because we would be bringing some sort of reputation to the business. And did I hear you correctly on that point?
Yeah, there is a kind of a catch-all category for services. We're not clear what that means. Okay, but it is a business that is created where the skill or reputation of the owner or of one of the employees is the principal asset of the business. Now, exactly how far the service is going to go in interpreting that in a situation like you just mentioned, we're not clear. For example, if I'm a restaurateur, the fact that the restaurant has my name on it, does that suddenly mean it's the reputation and skill of the owner? I would kind of think that's not a service. You're selling a product there, and maybe that business should qualify. But we are waiting for guidance, you know, on this from IRS.
Dan, I'm going to turn it over to you while I take care of some things.
Okay. So, Michael, I don't know why I haven't asked this question before, because we have had, since this whole thing started last fall, we've had a number of tax people. But I'm going to plead ignorance, and I'm looking for education from you. I'm probably going to get the number wrong, but I think that the omnibus bill was either 2,300 or 2,700 pages long. I don't
That's
care
right,
what
the omnibus bill was.
Yeah, the omnibus bill, the one that just passed.
Right.
2,300 to 2,700 pages long. As you pointed out, made some corrections of the tax bill that was passed last fall. What I'm trying to understand is who writes all this stuff, Michael. It can't be congressmen and senators. They don't have the time, nor do they have the knowledge and disposition. So who's drafting this legislation? Who's writing the 2,700-page bill? Is it staffers? Is it IRS? Who writes these bills?
Well, it's primarily the congressional staffers that are on the legislative committees that put together the actual legislative language. And, you know, when you talk about a bill being that long, it's now, in the case of the omnibus bill, that was actually that long in terms of legislative text. When you talk about the Tax Cuts Jobs Act bill, that was more like a 1,400-page document, but a good portion of it, probably maybe less than half, was commentary by the Joint Tax Committee. So it's primarily the members of the tax writing committees that and their aides and legislative staffers that write the actual text of the law, which is why there are a lot of deficiencies in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that need to be corrected through technical corrections that we're also waiting for, which, except for this one change that was made in the omnibus bill for the what was referred to as the grain glitch, the others haven't been addressed yet.
Are there any other things? I'm sorry. Is that you, Don?
Yeah.
Go right ahead, Dan. You're doing a great job because you know taxes and me don't agree.
They don't agree with me either, but I have to pay them. It seems to me that because I really do want to change subject a little bit. Our constituency, the people that listen to our show, are primarily small business people, people who are either thinking about starting a business, have a business, trying to grow a business, looking for advice and counsel. And there's a lot of rhetoric out there about the Republican tax cut last year. And there's some significant division between the Democrats and the Republicans. And I look at the decisions that corporate America has made in terms of moving back into the United States, increasing manufacturing, starting to build new manufacturing plants, hiring people. As a person who deals with the tax law, but also as a person who deals with businesses, what is your interpretation of the good or bad of the president's tax bill last fall?
I think in terms of most of the clients that I have dealt with, the issues and decisions that have been made concerning what they're going to do from a business perspective has not really focused primarily on the tax cuts bill, but it's been basically the economic environment. And I think that is really what's caused more in terms of the decisions to maybe relocate here as it was the specific result of change in tax policy. I think overall, large companies will benefit under the tax bill, so that's a positive. I just haven't seen that as being the key motivating factor. And part of that is we're still feeling our way through a lot of the provisions of the law to determine exactly what it means for particular businesses. So I think once that becomes clearer, we can then determine whether that becomes a major factor in businesses making decisions or not.
But if you look at, for example, within days after the president signed the bill, AT&T said they were going to pay for 200,000 employees a $1,000 bonus. And many other corporations either paid bonuses, increased wages, distributed stock to their employees. There was clearly a shift because of the tax bill in the thinking of management, at least initially as it related to, one, labor, and two, since we have now one of the lowest corporate tax rates in the world, a desire to want to move into the United States because the tax situation is so desirable. So I'm having just a little bit of problem, sir, trying to see where people are not being influenced in their decision-making process because of the tax bill.
Well, I think with respect to those companies you've talked about, which are clearly large companies, that the reduction in the tax rate was very significant. I think with respect to most businesses throughout the country, which are tend to be smaller businesses, the impact of the law is a little bit less clear because you're not getting that big shift from 35% to 21%. And we just discussed an aspect of the law that could benefit a lot of small businesses, but there's a lot of lack of clarity in terms of exactly what the rules are, how they affect particular businesses. I mean, if business is making is very profitable, they may lose the deduction. So it's just not that as clear with respect to most of the businesses, which tend to be flow-through businesses, that they are going to be impacted positively at the end of the day. Now,
so
maybe service will interpret the rules so as to benefit them, but that's why I'm saying I haven't seen that as being the biggest motivating factor. I think general economics is the thing that's driving most small businesses and their positive feelings about the future.
Do you expect, as you talked about a technical correction on the omnibus bill, are you expecting a technical correction on the tax bill?
Yeah, the one issue that we talked about that was in the omnibus bill was a correction of a provision that was in the tax bill, but there are lots of other areas that need technical corrections. There should be, as would be the case with any major piece of legislation, there are technical glitches all over the language of the bill. So we need that. Now, the question is whether Democrats will assist Republicans in bettering a bill that they were not in favor of to begin with, and whether they will look to extract other items of thin tax policy in order to assist the Republicans in that effort.
So I'll use the last question to give you an opportunity to give some advice to our listeners. What is the two or three things that you think that a small businessman needs to focus on as it relates to these changes in the tax law, both last year and now as it related to the omnibus budget bill?
Well, I think one of the things is that it would make sense, particularly if you are currently involved in a business, to, at the end of 17, do a projection on how you think that that's going to look under the 18 law, so that you get some sense of what you think the savings, in fact, will be, if there are some. Now, we have done these kinds of analyses for our clients, and they come out all over the range. There are some businesses that do quite better, and other businesses where the taxes have actually gone up. So that's something I think is useful to know, because you just can't generalize across the board that people will be better off under the tax bill or worse off. It is unfortunately a very individualized analysis that has to be made. So I think it would behoove everybody to sit down, have an analysis done under the new law of what your business was like in 17 to get a sense of whether you're going to get better cash flow or not.
Super. Thank you very much. Very informative.
Extremely informative. We've been talking to Michael Daddio, he's principal, tax and business at Markham. Michael, your website again and how people can reach you?
We're at www.markhamllp.com. I'm at Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, dot Daddio, D-A-D-D-I-O, at Markham, MarcumLLP.com.
Thank you so much. It's been an extremely illuminating time. Please come back in a couple of months after everybody's digested this and tell us more.
We'd love to be back on.
Thank you.
Dan, we only have time to say goodbye for today.
Well, it was a great show, and we had some terrific guests, and hopefully our listeners enjoyed it and also got some good ideas of some of the challenges of starting your own small business. So this is Dan Perkins.
And Don Mazzella.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.